Welcome to The Whole Marketer, where we look at the holistic skills, the technical skills, soft skills, leadership skills, and personal understanding that marketers of today need to grow the brands and businesses of tomorrow. We're here to ensure that marketers feel supported and empowered to have successful and fulfilling careers and lives as a whole. This episode is brought to you by Sticky Beak. I'm an advocate for consumer and customers being at the heart of our decision making. And our sponsors of today's episode can help you do just that. Sticky Beak is a platform that marketers have been dreaming of. Rapid global consumer testing to give you affordable, real-time feedback on all of your marketing activation, so you know what consumers think before you go to market and to get that all-important buy-in. Say goodbye to endless discussions and hello to faster, better decisions. Visit stickybeak.co/thewholemarketer to see how Sticky Beak are changing the way marketeers work. Hello and welcome to the Whole Marketer podcast. Welcome by today's guest, no other than the wonderful David McQueen, where we'll discuss his new book, The Brave Leader, More Courage, Less Fear for Better Decisions for Inclusive Leadership. David is a returning guest of the podcast, where we previously spoke on episode 102 about brave leadership. But today we're going to be talking about his new book and what it takes to be an inclusive leader and how to embed this in your organization and the much needed bravery that's needed to do so. But before I introduce David onto the podcast, let me tell you why I believe this to be so important. If we want to strive for more inclusivity in our society, workforces, and to ensure we have an accurate and true reflection of our customers' and consumers' needs, then it starts with inclusive leadership at all levels, making sure that everyone can be heard. Today's guest is David, an executive coach, international speaker, and board facilitator. He is passionate about helping others to explore how best leadership can work for them and their organizations. He is the host of the David McQueen podcast, where he interviews others about their leadership journey, as well as giving his own insight into what he's found with the work with his clients. He is a managing director of Q Squared, a leadership development firm, co-founder of Black Founders Hub, and a non-executive director for a number of non-profit organizations too. So David, welcome back to the Whole Marketer podcast.
Yes, and it's good to be back.
And exciting times for you to be back, having just launched your new book, The Brave Leader.
Indeed.
And we are going to explore lots of topics today, but the focus of today's podcast will be on inclusive leadership. So as always, we start with the big juicy question. What is inclusive leadership to you?
So for me, inclusive leadership is about ensuring in whatever way leadership shows up for you as an individual, if you're taking people on a journey, or even if you're developing a product or doing customer service, it's around making sure that in that position of leadership, you are fully aware and make as much effort as possible to be inclusive of all your stakeholders. So it's not just about talent. It's not just about hiring the right people, but it's around thinking about your leadership and thinking about all those different touch points that you have, which are going to make a massive impact on the people who are underneath your leadership. That's what inclusive leadership is for me.
So inclusive leadership to you is about ensuring you're aware of the impact that you are having on everyone in the organization and externally.
And I really link it to decision-making, right? So when I'm making a decision, how much of it am I thinking about the impact it will have on those who will be influenced by that decision? Again, whether it's staff, whether it's customers, whether it's the product I'm designing, whether it's the wider community or stakeholders I'm working in, what's that impact look like?
Because I think many people, as they think about inclusive leadership, almost think about it as, how do I ensure that I have represented all of society in both the recruitment across different communities, ethnicities, groups, belongings? So you've got that cross-section and diverseness of your workforce, as opposed to actually it's bigger than that. It's about the awareness and it's about the impact.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think there is a danger that when individuals only think of it within the realm of protected characteristics of people that they can hire, they kind of push themselves into the corner and they start to tick boxes. They start to go into situations that they're not very capable of handling. And for me, I think that kind of like goes against the whole ethos of what inclusion means for me. Yes, it's important to have a sense of belonging. I think that's one element of it. But I think a bigger part is going, you know, if I go into a shop, for example, and I ask for a service or I ask for a product, for me, inclusive leadership is then that organization has taken into consideration that as a customer, my needs and understanding can be catered for. Even if they don't have the products or service for me, at least the way the leadership runs in that organization, they can make me feel like I'm wanted. They can make me feel like I'm a valued customer when I'm in that space. That wider thinking can then be applied to all the other smaller, narrower niches that people may have.
The two themes that come into mind are the ability for them to feel heard and for them to feel wanted.
100%.
So as we just said, you've just launched your new book, The Brave Leader, Make Better Decisions for Inclusive Leadership with More Courage, Less Fear.
Yes.
Tell us, what drove you to write this book?
So a lot of it was based on my work. And for any listeners who aren't aware, the majority of my work is around leadership and executive coaching. So I call my company a professional development studio because I just love to play around with what does that look like if we're doing professional development stuff. And when I was thinking about a lot of the work that I did either one-to-one or in groups, very often I found people were quite intimidated because I would come bouncing into a room and I go, hey, everybody, you're going to go in and we're going to do X or Y. And sometimes people were like, oh, I could never do that. And then I realized that part of that lack of bravery was because they were comparing themselves to me as opposed to just thinking on what they were capable of doing. And so I really wanted to write a book that used the general word brave to talk about courage, to talk about being to step outside and to take risks. But I also wanted to be able to have a framework or an acronym that people could think about so that when they were leading in any situation, they can go, okay, how can I be brave? How can I be bold, resilient, agile, visionary, and ethical? So much of it was shaped by the work that I do. I've written it through the lens of a coach in helping people to start to explore and think for themselves as to what bravery means for them.
So almost a focus behind it is ensuring that you're imparting self-belief or giving them the tools to believe in their ability to, in absence of you being present to give them that belief.
100%. And I really wanted individuals to think about what are the kind of decisions or choices that I can make. Where do I go for these kinds of tools or strategies to think about what I'm going to do? And I mentioned that, you know, I give quite a few examples in the book of models that you can use. And it just allows the reader to be able to go, oh, you know, I didn't even realize that was a thing, but now I do. Let me see how I can apply it to my leadership.
And there are so many great tools and frameworks for the listeners to use when reading the book. And I can vouch for that having read it myself.
Thank you.
So when you sat down to write this book and we were just talking offline, the level of effort, time, energy, heart, soul, blood, sweat, tears that goes into writing a book, what were you hoping that the readers would think, feel and do having read your book?
To be honest with you, I had no idea what that was until I was about halfway through because I was like, if I ever finish this book today, I swear to God, I don't even know why I've been writing it. But about halfway through, I just wanted it to be really simple. I didn't want it to be some groundbreaking, heavy, oh, this is the silver bullet. This is the gospel truth around what this leadership looks like. I wanted it to be more of a space for people to pause and really reflect and go, okay, how can I be a bit braver? How can I allow this model and this framing to help not only me, but other people around me who I lead or who are aspiring to be leaders? How can I make them make those choices? And that's the thing that I wanted to give people the power of more than anything else. It was that power of choice and knowing what those choices were that were available to them. So that was the thing that was really driving me. I really wanted somebody to pick this up, go through it, see some of the case studies, see some of the models and stuff that could actually be used and understand how they can either map out or apply inclusion to the work that they do and then go, you know, okay, this one or two for me works really well. Let's see exactly how I can put this into practice. And the feedback that I've been getting from quite a few people show me that it's worked. So I'm quite happy with that.
Definitely. It's definitely a very conversational style and succinct and to the point. So you don't have to read pages and pages, or in my case, read over those pages and pages for it to land. I'm blessed to know you well. And it does sound like you and I having a conversation. And I'm sure others will enjoy that benefit also. So the want to inspire leaders to be better, to have that power of choice, using that brave model as a framework or acronym as a way of thinking through when you are inspiring leaders to be more inclusive in their thinking. One of the chapters in your book, you talk about mapping inclusion, which I thought was great because it starts to talk about the how, not just the aspiration to do this, and has lots of practical examples to bring this to life, all the way from addressing the recruitment of talent, all the way through to, you know, actually, how do I bring this to life in innovation and product development? Can you tell us why you believe it's so important for us to map those processes?
Yeah, so I think a big part of the work I do around coaching is getting clients to really think about how they can just map their own leadership journey, map their career. And so when I was going through this, I thought, oh, well, you know, what's the best way I can actually leave individuals with a way of mapping or a toolkit for themselves to navigate how leadership works really well, or in some situations, how it may not be working very well at all. The mapping bit for me was going right. Something to what we just said. So many times people hear about the belonging and inclusion, they only think about it in terms of talent. But how do we map an inclusive process in the way that we work with our suppliers, or the way that we are thinking about the way how we design our products, or even how inclusive do we make it so that when our people are using our specific products or service, that we've considered those access points. And I think of so many instances, like I mentioned in the book, around seatbelts being designed without women being born in mind. Got that from Caroline Criado Perez in her book, Invisible Women. And you realize it just makes no sense that for many years, you've got all these cars on the road and it was never designed for the average size of a woman. It was always designed for the average size of a man. Unfortunately, if somebody did have an accident, the outcomes were a lot more fatal for women than it were for men because it just was not designed for women. I think about a lot of the financial institutions now. You know, if you are in your 70s or 80s, going online to go and check your balance or make transfers is really kind of alien. For those individuals, they want to be able to go into a bank. I've got my checkbook or I've got whatever the resources and I want to make a payment. Just telling somebody that they need to have a smartphone and they need to be able to go and do this online or what have you will be totally alien to some people. And so for me, the big part of mapping it out is going, okay, have I taken into consideration the users that are using my products? And yes, I might give one set of users this option to be able to just jump on a phone but and do it here. But does that also give me the option for other people to be able to come in and have a conversation with an actual individual in order to get from A to B? So that mapping bit was more around just getting people to see the bigger picture rather than just reacting to like one singular incident.
And as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, actually, by thinking broader in your audience and making sure that you fully understand all of your users' needs, it probably is going to provide not only a growth opportunity, but an opportunity to offer greater customer experience, right?
Yes, yeah.
So you've got the commercial growth benefit of doing this, mm-hmm. but also the internal benefit of those that are doing this insight and gathering this work to build a greater level of thinking, but also for them, if they feel that they're being heard and represented, you know, imagining the women that are working in the organization that are manufacturing that seatbelt going, great, I'm working on a product that doesn't even reflect my own needs, let alone the society as a whole. That doesn't feel particularly motivating.
Yeah. And that's why for me, it is brave because, you know, if you've been making millions of pounds off your cars and what have you, and you've never had to think about this, all of a sudden someone's coming in and go, right, we need to spend on R&D or innovation and stuff and make a bit more of an effort to be more inclusive to half of the users of our cars. For some individuals, if they're not thinking about it beyond the bottom line and beyond the cost of, you know, the short-term cost of being able to get the supplies and the materials, then, you know, you're not going to get the chance that that person is going to be very inclusive. However, if you're saying, all right, what does this look like from a commercial point of view, where the LTV, the long-term value of that customer is, right, you don't have to go out there, to use a really clear sales term, there's that cost of acquisition where you're spending all your effort and money just trying to get a new customer, when if you can double down and just make some tweaks, you can actually get a customer that will stay with you for a longer time because they've realized that you've made the extra effort to understand exactly where they're coming from. And when I think about a number of conversations I've had with clients, they will say to me, oh, I never really thought about that. Yeah, because you're under pressure because you have to do things in the short term. But if you could think slightly longer and think slightly beyond just having that short-term result, there's something powerful about being able to think around, how can I make sure from a commercial point of view that I can keep this customer for even longer than if I didn't take any notice or any care around the specific needs that they have.
And for me, that brings us back to that concept of being wanted and heard. You know, if customers feel that they're wanted, feel their needs are being heard, it's got an external benefit as well as an internal benefit.
Yes.
As I'm listening to you, David, one thing's really come into my mind, and it's about psychological safety.
Yes.
Listening is so important, and employees, stakeholders, customers feeling that they can be heard and that they are safe to do so. You know, there must have been so many people. If we use that example again with the seatbelts, that were like, this is fundamentally wrong.
Yeah.
That didn't speak up. And I can't help but feel that they probably didn't speak up because they didn't feel like they were safe or welcome to do so.
Yeah. And again, there's a key point that I make in the book about leadership being systemic rather than it just being about a singular leader, that I do believe it's got to be something, it's a lot wider. It's a lot bigger than that. Because if that one person leaves the organization, that one leader leaves the organization, then how do you have a continuation of that conversation if it's not systemic? And so that affects so many of the choices that are made by individuals because they're only thinking about how do I do it for myself, or how do I win over this kind of people, or how do I get promotion, or how do I get this, you know, performance rating? Whereas for me, there's something so much more to be said around it, around those decisions being a lot more systemic. When I make a decision and I've really thought the process through, how does this not only affect me and the people that I work with in my division or in my small team, but what does this also look like if I extend it to other teams? And I think about one of the challenges that I had when thinking about this book. I think about a number of organizations or companies that I've either worked with or that I know of where they pride themselves in working in silos. One team will just not know about the other. And from my personal point of view, I'm like, man, if I'm working in an organization, I'm nosy as hell. I just want to know from people exactly what's going on and how this impacts my behavior, impacts all these other points. There's been a constant series of conversations I've had where I go, look, how do you know how effective your leadership has been? And what about people in other departments or other areas? How is that impacting you? And so I'm not sure if I'm answering the specific question that you had, but there is something around really understanding that those decisions are not just down to just one person in one department, but rather how does that work in an ecosystem? Like, it's a bit like your body, right? Your leg can't just suddenly bugger off and start walking down the road on its own. Well, it can, but you know, it'll look really awkward. But it's got to be part of your whole body movement. And very often, I think people just think of themselves as a visible or invisible hand that can just go and do stuff on its own, rather than thinking about how does this affect the whole ecosystem and all the joined up bits? How does it make it work properly? And that's what I really wanted to get out, is how do I get people to think about it in the sense of the larger system? Does that answer the question? I'm not sure.
Yes and no. So I've written down here, as you've been talking, well thought through decisions.
Yeah.
What's loud and clear is not only do I have the ability to be heard, which for me is psychological safety, you know, being able to speak up and people to listen without negative consequence. It sounds like it's bigger than psychological safety for you. It's more about actually how much have I thought through this decision?
Yes.
Or how much have I thought through why this is important? So when I do bring this to the organization, it benefits more than just one team, one individual, one customer across the whole organization. And that actually to make impact, yeah, it has to be systemic.
Yeah. Come back to the point around the psychological safety. One of the things I will say is that psychological safety is quite contextual. Some people that may have, to use Nicholas Taleb's phrase, they might have developed a system that's quite anti-fragile. So they know that there is going to be bounces, know that there's going to be some stuff that's going to come against them. And they may go, right, we're going to rock with this. A psychological safety for them may be very different from somebody who comes from an underrepresented background, or maybe neurodiverse, mm-hmm, or maybe not really heard of in that space. And it's interesting because a big part of this conversation for me has been around moving away from just a dependency on safe spaces or how people see safe spaces and creating braver spaces so that there can be even more robust conversations, but they can still be done with compassion and empathy. What I think a lot of people confuse when they talk about psychological safety and safe spaces is that they think that they have to tiptoe around issues. They think that they have to go in there and they mustn't say anything just in case they offend people. And I'm like, if you go into a situation and you've already created a context as to where this conversation is going or to where this dialogue is going, then of course you're going to make mistakes. Mm. And of course you may say things wrong. But because the context has been shaped at the beginning, individuals can then have the conversation to go, right, well, I hear what you're saying, but this, you're missing out on the context, or this is something that I don't agree with. And that's absolutely fine. That's the brave space you create to go, I don't have to agree with you. I understand where you're coming from. And this is really informative and I understand it, but I don't agree with you in making this work. You know, for example, there are going to be in the UK or in North America, there may be conversations around diversity when it comes to things like race and sexual orientation. If I took that to, say, certain parts of the Middle East or even to Europe or what have you, it's a very different context altogether. And what shows up as psychological safety in one space is very, very different in another. So I'm always saying that it's quite contextual. And a big part of this is the bravery is being able to set the context, but being able to ask questions what works here and what doesn't work here. There are certain territories that I know I couldn't rock up into and go, right, you need 50% women on the board. They'd look at me like, dude, are you trying? Number one, are you trying to harm us? And number two, are you trying to harm the people that would end up going for those roles and being, you know, undermined or losing their specific safety? So to come back to your point, I think there is something around that psychological safety, but it is beyond that. It is around going, how do we make ourselves more robust as a collective, not just as individuals, but as a collective, to be able to explore, to be innovative, to be creative, but not to do it at the expense of losing your compassion.
Yeah, not the expense of compassion, and also the bravery to speak up, but also the safety that if you do, the consequences are minimal culturally.
Yes.
Which leads me on to another question I wanted to ask you, which is around culture shifts. Because, you know, adopting this style systemically is going to take big cultural shifts, which you actually face into in the book, which I love, by the way. We're not just saying, oh, we need to make cultural changes and then off you go. You know, you're actually talking about the shifts. So one of the questions I want to ask you is, so when you do face into cultural shifts, what is it that needs to happen in order for these to be actualized and come to fruition?
So I think there has to be alignment. There's got to be a lot of alignment. And again, I'll go back to this point. I didn't mention it in the book, but one of the things I really love around is around leadership agility. And that agility is the ability to be able to flex and to be able to communicate to individuals that reaction to that flexibility in an actual moment. And, you know, when there are big shifts, I think of some of the major shifts that have happened in the last few years since I've been doing a lot of this work, whether it's been around gender equality, racial equality, whether it's been around how you deal with staff who are impacted by family or friends in zones of conflict, whether it be around the fact that the economy is having a massive change and a lot of organizations that hired and overhired in the pandemic then cut a massive sway through all the staff that were there to reduce staff levels down to not bare bones, but literally when you're talking about an organization that's chopped 40,000 of its staff, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of people. And you know, a big part of it for me is not to say to organizations that you can't cut staff, because that's just not economically feasible. It's not to say that any promise you made around representation from underrepresented groups any time that they can't be done, but it's just about being really sensible around it. If you know that you've got a group of candidates and you want to have 50% more women on your board, but you know of the eight possible positions, you've only got two women in the organization that are capable of actually fitting into that space, there's no point trying to just manipulate it just because you made a promise a little while back. There's got to be so much more nuance and context around how that actually works out. And so for me, a lot of that comes back to, what are the values or principles of the actual organization? What is it, those things that you say you're actually standing for? And then when you start to make those choices or moves around being more inclusive, how do they align up to all the things that you say drive the company in the first place? So we're talking about honesty, if we're talking about integrity, if we're talking about innovation, if we're talking about representation, are you able to do those things inclusively, regardless of who the cohort is there? And do you measure and chop and reflect and measure and chop and reflect? Is it a constant process? Or is it a small tick box that you've got that just makes it feel really good when somebody picks up, I don't know, your end of year report and they look and they see some shiny stuff. But the people who are actually working, they go, no, this isn't real. This isn't actually real. And my question is always to those people who are in positions of leadership, are you in any way in a position of doubt that some of what you've said, there'll be other people in the organization who wouldn't agree with you because they think that you're talking about your posterior?
Oh, that's a really great reflective question. If your statement, this is the culture in the organization, is that what others would state also?
Yes.
I don't think enough of people do that. No. I really don't. And I think we did a lot of research recently into coaching within organizations and talk about coaching cultures and actually how do they evolve? You know, do they evolve from the start of someone who's hired an external coach and seen the benefits of it and then thinks about developing a pool of internal coaches? And then thinks, oh, this is quite a good leadership style for our leaders to adopt and so on. Or is it those that come in and go, oh, we're going to adopt this cultural style and then everyone else has to retrofit and nothing really happens. And to your point, they haven't got the buy-in and people aren't aligned and don't see the need. And I think a lot of organizations are probably somewhere in between both of those things and therefore sometimes struggling to really embed those cultural shifts that are required to make these changes.
Yeah. And it's bloody hard work.
It is bloody hard work.
And there are organizations that for that shift to happen. Sometimes you look at the way that can work and you crunch all the numbers and you look at all the models and you look at the change in economic circumstances and you sit and you're across from somebody and go, do you know what, for this to really work, it may take 4 to 5 years. And they'll look back at you and they'll say, we haven't got that time. And I'm like, well, you have if you want to.
Yeah.
But you choose not to is a whole different story altogether. When I think of, again, the overhiring that was made in the pandemic, I honestly don't think it was overhiring. I think there was a massive surge. And what a lot of those organizations did is they realized that they're going to need to have a lot more people on board, but they never ever framed it as something that was going to be temporary. And I believe a lot of them knew that it was going to be temporary because this stuff, you know, we have economic cycles and booms and busts. Things never just last forever. People know this. And I think what was missing there was just a lack of integrity to go, right, we're going to go and do this, but it's not going to be something that's going to be permanent. We have to readjust. We have to recalibrate. If the economic circumstances and if times change, we have to recalibrate. And I think there's something beautiful and brave about an organization where someone goes, look, you know, we're taking on new staff. They're probably more contractual, more short term, because if anything does happen in the midterm, you know, we need to make an adjustment. And those who are contracting or temporary, they'll be the ones who probably have to go. But who's brave enough to say that?
Who is brave enough to say that? But it comes back to honesty and integrity. I can't think who would dip out in that situation from that honesty and integrity. From the person being recruited to knowing that this isn't permanent yet, to taking the pressure off those that are adding this headcount, but that extra resource line on the P&L and stressing over it. You know, I can't see who would dip out from the honesty and integrity. Of course, those being recruited may feel less of a sense of belonging, may have concerns about the longevity, both personally and professionally. If you've been recruited under that premise, then at least it's been done so in a space of honesty for both parties and an honest choice as well for both parties.
Has to be.
One of the key catalysts for change is personal understanding. Personal understanding of the individuals, people in your care, but also you as a leader. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I loved in your book was that you highlight the importance of coaching as an enabler to help leaders enhance that skill, but also the skills and effectiveness within their organizations. Why do you think organizations, and maybe this is just more an Abby point of curiosity that I hope everybody else will also benefit from, is why do you think so many organizations are yet to realize the benefits of that personal understanding in their leaders at all levels?
For some, it's command and control. If I'm in a position where I just need you to come in and whack out a couple of hours and not really think for anything more than bringing me in a couple more coins, there is a reluctance to give that person a sense of agency. I'll give you a very quick example if I can. I was organizing a dinner, and the dinner was with a number of individuals from a number of tech organizations. And it was by invitation only. It was very offline or what have you. And I lost about 3 or 4 people coming to that dinner, because what had actually transpired was, and again, it wasn't a dinner that was popular, although I had told the individuals, what had actually transpired is that 1 or 2 of them had been warned not to go there because they were afraid of being poached by the competition. So you imagine, for the sake of argument, I've got these individuals who are in my network who I think it would be brilliant for them to meet and connect, because all these tech and media and finance companies, I get to meet these people all the time. Why not share your learning? And there was a real strong fear. There was a really, really strong fear that if they came, then, you know, some people may go and they might get hired and they may lose out. And what I realized more than anything, which kind of like comes back to your original question, is a lot of people have fear that's not actually even based in reality, but rather in this notion or ideology that they think in their head that if A plus B equals C, there can't be any other alternative. And so people become very, very fearful around those choices. Whereas I'm saying, look, if you've got somebody who's come to your organization and you can create an environment and a space which allows them to really, really thrive and do really well, but they can also be in a position where they can coach others, where they can empower others. If that person then leaves, and for many organizations that may be the case, that's okay, because what they've been able to do is they've been able to create a coaching environment where people can have this conversation and have an understanding, which doesn't need you to be there all the time. It might be that they just learn something different and something new. So there's a lot of reluctance because people want to have that command and control. Is there a lot of reluctance because people are afraid that people may go away and leave if they are empowered? But I think that's quite misguided. And even if somebody does leave, the truth is there's probably 1, 2, 3, or 4 other people out there just as qualified, if you look deep enough, who can come in and who can do the job. But yeah, people are just scared of their own shadow.
That's an interesting viewpoint. I thought you were going to say something more around they haven't understood the power of their personal understanding and the empowerment that that gives them, as opposed to what I'm hearing is they do and they actually don't want to share it, because if they 100%. Share it, then they might leave.
Oh, no, they know. Mm. I think the one thing I realize more than anything in my coaching practices is that they know. People feign ignorance around a lot of stuff that they actually do know. Because if they feign out ignorance and can pretend that it's not a thing, you're not going to get called on it. You're not going to get questioned on it. But I know when a coach, when I'm sitting in the room with you, like you are literally naked to the extent, not in a weird way, but I'm going to ask you questions and you are going to be exposed. I'm not going to dilly dally around it just because you got CEO on the door and you're getting paid north of 200 or 1,000. That means no difference to me. You ask me to come in and do a job, I'm going to challenge you on that. And a lot of people do know the answers. Like, you know, a lot of organizations know where they can hire more women or any other underrepresented group, but they choose to go with the same recruitment agency over and over again. They know where they can go and get the difference. So it's not like they don't know. It's just that weird sense of, right, if it ain't broke, or at least in their mind, if it ain't broke, we're not going to go and try and fix it. And it's not that we're telling people it's broken, but you can actually get something better.
It's the whole growth / fixed mindset piece that's happening. And also, if they're going to be exposed, it's probably going to highlight a change that they know already that they're going to need to make. And we all know that change takes work and effort and energy and do all of the above.
Yeah, and it does. A lot of change management programs don't succeed because, again, there's a lack of alignment. A lot of people are just not aligned. And there is a lot to be said for people being honest about what they do know and how they step into that space. And very often people just don't. As I said, they're terrified of what that consequence means if the change works and they think that's not going to work in their favor.
So in order to make it work, you need the honesty, the integrity, the growth mindset, the personal understanding, the systemic changes, do all of the above and everything else that we have discussed so far. And David's book, The Brave Leader, outlines in a conversational way the tools, the techniques to go about doing that and being brave to make those changes. David, thank you so much for the time that you spent so far on today's podcast.
That was a pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me back. And I know this is not, I honestly know, and I say this to individuals all the time, I know this is not an easy subject to tackle. And I think when you factor in the nature of the economic climate, even right now, or sometime in the future, maybe a bit shaky, when you factor into the fact of if you're working with global clients, factoring in all the cultural context that needs to come in there as well. And there's a political climate as well. Like I think about, you know, so many in the US and even increasingly here in the UK, there's this pushback against what they see as DEI work or woke work, as they call it. You know, when people are calling for equality, they think that people are getting treated negatively, especially people who are being treated in favor. If you were in a position where you were middle class when you were wealthy and you were male and all the rest of it, all of a sudden now you find that other people are coming in to have a piece of that pie and that cake, and you get defensive and you're like, oh, you know, I don't understand why all this woke shit is happening and all this kind of stuff. I want to be able to do things slightly differently. And I realize that for a lot of the fears that people have around that, many of them unfounded, but for a lot of the fears that they have, this is just the bit where we go, all right, let's have that conversation. Let's be really honest. Where can we take this and how good can we take it to the next level? And you're going to win some and you're going to lose some. But I love being in that position where I can actually start the conversation with individuals so that they can see it slightly differently.
So we can start that conversation. But as you know, we always finish these whole marketer conversations with the following question. And it feels unfair to ask this question when you've given us so much already. But I'm going to ask it anyways. What one piece of advice would you give to marketers of tomorrow?
So to go back to the title of my book, be brave around not just what's happening in the short term, but what it looks like in the mid to long term as well. And don't swap easy wins and gains for long-term relationship and growth. Don't go for the easy wins. Can be really simple to do that, but then you end up having to pick up the pieces and trying to mend bridges that if you had just taken the time out to go, right, let's think about this slightly deeper and a bit more inclusively, what could that result look like? And again, there are all the pressures that marketers are going to get from different stakeholders internally and externally. And I'm not dismissing those, but I just think it's important to take a step back and go, all right, when I do make this decision, what impact will it have?
That's a great piece of advice. And thank you again so much for your time on today's podcast.
Absolute pleasure, my lovely.
Thank you for tuning into the Whole Marketer podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do like, follow, and share. The Whole Marketer is here to support and empower you and your teams with the latest technical skills, soft and leadership skills and behaviours, and personal understanding for a successful, fulfilling marketing career and life as a whole. For support, resources and more information on how we can help you to become a Whole Marketer and build whole marketing teams, go to www.thewholemarketer.com.